the snow is destroying my house. We'll see if it remains standing. I keep thinking this house has been here since 1932. It's not going to fall down this year, but you know, it's got to fall down some year, and I'll probably be in it when it does.
So if you want to know how to polarize our audience, and we've talked about some controversial things in the past, we've talked about all sorts of things, not really ever politics or religion, but we've come as close as one can get. And it's not the abuse of women in the technology industry. That is actually not very controversial to our audience, which is good. But man, if we talk about cars, holy hell, do people get upset. And then some people love it. And then people get upset. And then other people love it. And then people get really upset.
Who's getting upset? Who's are people yelling at you about stuff? Most people are in a joking way about, oh, talking about cars, haha. But like, they seem pretty okay with it.
I don't know about you, Marco, but I've seen some pretty angry either tweets or emails about the car talk.
I didn't really feel a lot of anger. There were a couple of tweets that were like, oh, I guess I'll skip this one. But they were pretty mellow. I mean, compared to what we got when we did Neutral, you know, Neutral had like 200 really upset people and 100 people who liked it. And that was it. and this seemed to, I was surprised, actually. I was very surprised how many people enjoyed my Tesla review, because I thought I was very nervous about even including that. Because I was afraid people would think that I'm some elitist asshole.
Should have just made a blog post, see? It would have been fine.
No, that would have been worse. No. I would never put that on my blog, because I would have had so many... You know, people who listen to this tend to like us more, I think, than the average blog reader. If I post something on my blog, I get a whole bunch of hate from like drive-bys. Whereas with podcasts, you don't really have drive-by readers or listeners to a podcast. You know, like people who are here tend to like you. I mean, with the exception of like MTW, everybody else tends to like us, you know. So I'm not like it. You can say like more possibly controversial things on a podcast, and you can expect that the audience will give you the benefit of the doubt, or will know you a little bit better, or will understand you a little bit better, you know. So I feel way more comfortable saying things on podcasts than I do, and especially on our podcast, than I do writing it on my blog.
You need to go on Analog with Casey and talk through these issues that you have about feeling bad about buying nice things with your money.
Actually, that is a very interesting point.
And an alternate solution, if you find that too onerous, is to give all your money to me. I have no such problems.
The funny thing about you, John, is that even if I gave you all the money in the world to go like buy Ferraris and stuff, you still wouldn't do it.
I have different priorities than you, so the ranking of what's the first thing you buy, the second thing you buy, someone may be different, but I would have no problem like blogging about the expensive thing that I bought, being afraid, but you know, whatever, like that's me, that's you, we're different people. That's why I said you either need to get rid of all that nasty money that's bothering you, or
go on
to Casey's Feeling Show and talk about cheese food.
Yeah, it's different for you. You know, people believe you.
Oh, God. That's funny, though, because I, of the three of us, I would peg you as the least willing to talk about all the fancy crap that you bought.
Oh, no way. I'm talking about my TV for hours. It's like the fanciest thing I own. It's all I talk about. What are you talking about? I'm totally willing to talk about the fancy things that I have.
I also forget that you talking about things that you like really amounts to you bitching and moaning about those things, rather than being like, look at me and how awesome my Tesla is.
I would have complaints about a Ferrari. I mean, it's like an exotic car. There's probably like all sorts of ergonomic issues and everything. Like, but I would talk about the good things too. I mean, I was just looking at the pictures in that Verge article. Someone had the 488, a bunch of pictures, like the first non-press, you know, non like glamour shots that Ferrari takes of the car. And so you get to see it from different angles and see the awkward parts or whatever. And they had a shot of the interior showing like the seat controls on the side of the seat. And I was like, boy, when that door closes, it's tough to get your fingers down there to feel those seat controls. And it's like, Ferrari doesn't care about the ergonomics of how easy it is to reach the seat controls. That's not what this car is about.
You know what we got to do? So, I mean, you know, there are companies like, I forget the names of them, but there are some companies that, like in New York and LA and stuff that will rent supercars to you for like a few $1,000s a day.
My wife tried to do that once and I
really
turned it down. Yeah. Cause like, can you imagine something worse? I mean, Marco, you can relate to this when you owning cars, like someone else's expensive car that you are renting, like, ooh, and especially the one she was looking at was like in a city, like having a Ferrari in the city of Boston, like it was pointless. Like, why not just take it and rub it upside down on top of some gravel? Like, it's not even, you're not driving it. It's abuse.
We have to get a sponsor to make this happen, to pay for a one day rental of whatever your chosen Ferrari is that's currently available through these rental places, a one-day rental for you just to have you evaluate it the way you evaluate things.
I don't know. Maybe if it was a sponsor thing, who knows? I would feel very nervous driving someone else's car. And it would have to be during the summer, for crying out loud.
No, it'd be even better now.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
no, Ferraris are not allowed on the street. I see occasionally. I have seen in my life in the Boston metro area a completely blasted, road salt covered, slush destroyed red Ferrari out in the winter. So somebody's doing it.
That person, I have immense respect for, whoever that is.
Yeah, seriously, this 488 is pretty. I'm looking at this Verge article. It's nice.
All right, we should get the follow-up before we turn this into neutral again.
Too late.
Now it's like, now when we're doing the show, I'm thinking, oh, where is Marco going to put the car opening and closing sounds? To get back to what you were talking about, the people with the feedback about the car stuff, I mean, most people, I think, are just bemused by it and joking about it. And, like, I think they're joking because it's like, look, if there's a rumor that Apple's going to make a car, we're going to talk about it on a tech podcast that's focused a lot on Apple. Like, blame Apple. We didn't tell them to make a car, you know?
Blame 9to5 Mac and the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, if they have rumors of them making a boat, we'd be talking about boats.
Ay, ay, ay. All right, so now that we've wasted 10 minutes, would you like to do some follow-up?
Yeah, guess what it's about. Sorry, guys.
Oh, God, this is the best. All right, so let's talk about cars.
Yeah, first one is from William Faraday, or Faraday. It's better if it's Faraday, because I think he works for Tesla. And he says that Tesla reports margins. We were saying, like, what do we think the margins are on Tesla's cars versus what they imagine that might be on Apple's cars. And he says the margins are about 25%. The goal is 30%. And then he says, thanks for believing in us. Model S is bonkers awesome. So by saying believing in us, I assume he works for Tesla.
No, I wouldn't actually assume that. Let me remember for a second there. Tesla fans are crazy. Like, and we've had, and I will probably count myself among those, you know, in a year or two, whatever. But Tesla fan, I've never encountered fans that were as devoted and incredibly loud and overprotective as they are. You know, it kind of, you know, Elon Musk himself has, you could tell he's extremely oversensitive, much to a fault, actually, whenever anybody says anything he perceives to be unfair or incorrect about Tesla's in news or in reviews. There, you know, there's that whole scandal with Top Gear, then the scandal with the New York Times, and like all this stuff, you know, and I think I would say Elon reacts poorly. I would say it's necessary to react to these things if, you know, it's necessary to, like, you know, issue statements and stuff if you disagree, but the way he does it, I think, is not beneficial overall. But the fans have seemingly taken that on themselves. Like, the owners have like taken that, like, kind of like the scrappy upstart underdog attitude on themselves, and boy, there is no woodwork that can hold them back. I mean, it is, if you say anything, they jump all over you, good or bad. And so it was very helpful to me when I was honestly looking into this and giving this a fair shot. I got tons of amazing information from Tesla owners, tons of, you know, how you take road trips, how, you know, what are the good things, what are the bad things about these cars. Everybody is willing to share this information. Everybody has tons of things to say, and everyone's like, please, I will never buy an internal combustion engine, which they all abbreviate ICE. I will never buy an ICE car again. You have to come over. It's amazing. You'll never go back, etc. It is the most devoted, nearly rabid fan base I've ever seen of anything. It's really something.
It's funny because, and I don't mean this to be funny at all, it reminds me of the way I perceived Apple fans before I became one of them, you know,
yeah.
Like just ravenously excited about their company. And I also thought it was quite funny that more than a couple of people tweeted at Elon Musk saying, oh my God, you have to listen to this M5 owner talk about how wonderful the P85D is. Check out this podcast, which I thought was quite funny.
I'm sure he'll work that into his schedule in between launching rockets into space.
One of the reasons why I'm interested in the Tesla now is that, you know, Elon Musk has some, maybe many of the qualities Steve Jobs had, in the sense that, and to some degree Jeff Bezos has, but I think Steve and Elon do a better job of it, this kind of like crazy billionaire with really high standards and pretty high product ambitions. I kind of miss that from Apple, and we still get great stuff from Apple. And we'll, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about next week's event, you know, now and then when it happens, and I'm sure we'll say, oh, this stuff is great. But that spirit of like the charismatic kind of crazy leader who pushes everyone to do pretty crazy stuff, that's rare. And Elon, I think, is one of those. And I'm kind of interested in joining one of those product fan bases again, you know?
I think the reason Tesla fans are as rabid as you say they are, and why Casey perceived Apple fans to be like that before coming on, is I think you need to have a company that you recognize, or that the fans recognize, as having a superior product, but that the world does not recognize yet. So you have to be an underdog. So like, the Mac was just so much better than Windows 3.1. It was ridiculous. It was even worse than Tesla versus other cars. And yet the entire world considered the Mac a silly toy and not a real computer. And that breeds rabid fans. Same thing with the Amiga. Like, you think, guys, don't you see this is so awesome? Why is it only me and my 7 nerdy friends who see that this is awesome? The world has to know, and they'll defend it, and so on and so forth. Once you stop being the underdog and become the overdog, and just like, the entire world knows that Apple is really good and everything, then you tend to chill out more. So, Casey, your perception could have been right back when Apple was beleaguered and on the ropes and so on and so forth. Or maybe it was just like, you know, it takes a while for that perception of the fans to turn around. But Tesla is definitely the underdog at this point because they make super expensive cars and not many people can buy them. And the people who own them think they're great. But other people think either A, they're too expensive and I can't afford one, or B, you know, they'll run out of batteries or whatever other FUD is out there about electric cars, and that's what they're combating. But anyway, like, so you think this tweet, William Faraday, he should tweet us back and say, thanks for believing in us. You think he's saying us as in we Tesla owners? I mean, I totally read that as him saying that he works for Tesla.
Well, and I did hear from a couple of people who work for Tesla, and you know, nobody whose names anybody would recognize as far as I know, but you know, just people who, like, they listed their employer in their Twitter bio as Tesla, and one of them was wearing a Tesla jacket in his picture, so it's like pretty obvious. they're out there.
Yeah, I think I clicked on this Twitter thing and looked at the bio to see if you work for Tesla and didn't come up with anything, but anyway, there's one Tesla fan / employee's opinion.
All right. And what else do we have with relation to cars, perhaps self-driving cars?
Yeah, we talked about that. I said could have something like that at Disneyland or you know, some confined area where the routes are well-known, sort of basically like self-driving buses or whatever. And Michael Lewis or Luis Brown wrote to say that Heathrow Airport has self-driving car-like pod things that take you to and from the parking lot. We'll put a link in the show notes. You can take a see what they look like. It shows them going in a little road that's barely big enough to fit the thing. So anyway, it's a driverless thing that people go in that goes on something that resembles roads. It's not on rails. It's not on tracks. There's actually wheeled vehicles in a confined place. So that's, you know, that's already a thing. And I think someone also said that in Disney World, they have something like that as well. As part of some ride or something. And like I said, they have this stuff like this in factories. So yeah, the tech to do it in limited circumstances has been with us for a while, and now it is slowly spreading.
Well, now, are these actually self-controlled? I did not read this article, but because this looks a lot like, and actually it's labeled, the caption on this picture is PRT, which is Personal Rapid Transit. I have a friend that went to Virginia Tech for his undergraduate degree, like I did, and that's where we met. And then he went to West Virginia University for his law degree. And in West Virginia, they have, or at WVU, they have these things they call the PERT, Personal Rapid Transit. And it's straight out of like 65 or something like that. But they're these little orbs and that don't look too dissimilar from what I'm looking at here. And as you walk in, you push a button on this console that's clearly straight from like 73 or whenever this thing started. And that tells the computer system where you'd like to go. And then you wait and the computer system dispatches a driverless orb thing. And then you wait until it shows up. It says that, you know, I'm going to the engineering building or whatever. And then you step in and it magically takes you to the engineering building. And it's on like a kind of elevated track that doesn't look too dissimilar from this road in this picture from Heathrow. it is ancient and kind of busted and beaten down, and it was awesome. And I kind of wish I had one nearby. I bring all this up to say that this is not new technology, and this has been around for a long time. Now, perhaps the difference, though, is that these Heathrow ones may genuinely be self-driving, whereas the ones at WVU are clearly operated by a computer based out of like 92 or something like that.
Yeah, well, it doesn't really matter whether they're centrally controlled by a computer or controlled by a computer that's on board the thing for the purposes of, you know, shuttling to and from two places. Like, a computer is controlling it. It's deciding when to accelerate, when to brake, when to turn. You know, like, I'm sure the road itself has sensors in it to keep it on track or whatever. It's, you know, it's limited controlled circumstances. You know, it's not out on the open road, but this is where all these things start. And then, you know, you get all those DARPA challenges and things that Google's doing to work out the problems in the real world.
All right. Now, this same individual, Michael, also had some other feedback for us.
Yeah, about the 16 biggest transport ships in the world pollute as much as all the cars. Internet meme story thing or whatever. Our intrepid listeners track that down to its source, which looks like a presentation in 2009 from something called the DK Group. It's all about pollution. It is a slide show thing. We'll put a link in the show notes. You can go through the 55 slides they have on this presentation and see that it is kind of game of telephone morphed into X number of ships pollute more than all the cars in the world. If you look at the presentation, it gets into specifics. They're not like, they have stats about CO2. They have it about sulfur oxide compounds as well. And the sulfur ones is what they're focusing on for the 15, 16 ships things. But they also talk about the CO2 levels, and there's no bite size. Like, this has been distilled down into an impressive sounding stat. There are actually equally impressive stats in here that just don't boil down as nicely. And you can find echoes of it in, like, there's a story in The Guardian from a similar amount of time. There's a TED Talk that cites it. And every time it gets cited, it becomes more kind of like vague. Like, even in 2009, when The Guardian citing it says, confidential data from the maritime industry insiders based on engine size and the quality of fuel typically used by ships and cars shows that 15 of the world's biggest ships may now emit as much pollution as all the world's seven, like, as much pollution? Well, is that exactly what they said?
Yeah, see, this is why it was so confusing, because, you know, because when you mentioned this last week, I, in my head, assumed that you were talking about just, like, fossil fuel consumption, and not emissions of certain chemicals. And so that makes complete sense, which is, like, it's who knows if this is true, but it's at least plausible, because there's so much regulation on how much of certain chemical pollutants that cars are allowed to emit in all, you know, all over the world. And ships are presumably pretty much unregulated because they're in the ocean in the middle of nowhere most of the time. And so it does make sense that, like, you know, they could throw enough crap in the air that cars would have to use, you know, filters and converters to not emit.
Well, yeah, and I had originally had it in my head as CO2, which is like all the greenhouse gases, like, if you want to combat, you know, global warming and everything, that you want to get rid of the cars. And, you know, I've talked about the farting cows, which are a big thing, because methane is a stronger greenhouse gas than CO2. But it's not, like, it's like you said, it's not so much about the CO2 of these ships, which is significant, but the other things that are in the fuel, because they use the cheapest, crappiest fuel possible, and they don't care anything about what's being spewed out of their pipes. And so it's not like they use more fuel than all the 15 ships use more fuel than all the cars in the world.
Right.
That when they burn that fuel, this calls it the pollution. Well, is CO2 pollution? I think they're mostly talking about the other crap that's in the fuel, not the CO2, but the other stuff that, you know, cars have been regulated down to not, you know, or have catalytic converters and other things to stop the stuff from going out. Anyway, that's why we'll link to the actual presentation in the show notes so you can look at it. But every time it gets repeated, it sort of morphs. And, like, this pollution summary, it's not inaccurate. It just depends. Like, once someone says pollution, then the next person to decide it's going to say CO2. Or CO2 and other gases, or, you know, like, you can phrase it in a way that is still correct, but is slowly drifting away from the meaning. So if you care, check out the presentation. It's interesting. Anyway, Elon Musk will do that next. Make container ships that work entirely on battery. Of course, a lithium-ion battery big enough to move a container ship would probably produce more pollution in the creation of that battery than the ship ever would. But,
or charging it.
I don't know. Shipping's pretty easy. You know, like energy consumption-wise, it's pretty efficient to float things across the ocean.
Well, you say that, but in a prior life, so to speak, I actually worked on navigation systems for big, big, big ships. And at one point, I actually took a business trip to Helsinki, Finland, to talk to a company that would take hyper, hyper accurate models of ocean currents. And they would say, okay, if you're, I don't know, maybe carrying an M5 or many M5s, as the case may be, and you're leaving Germany and you're going to New York, and you know, the most direct route will be, and I'm completely making this up, 2,000 nautical miles. Well, if you are willing to go 100 or 200 nautical miles out of your way, you can catch this awesome current that will save you 50% on fuel. And granted, I'm making these numbers up, but the difference was tremendous. And when you're talking about a vehicle that big, it was a trip, just an indescribably large amount of fuel, like measured in hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars worth of fuel. And so this was all based on hugely accurate predictions of ocean currents. It was the most fascinating technology in the world. And I kind of wish that I was still privy to what's going on with that company, because I thought it was amazing.
Our first sponsor this week is Fracture. Fracture prints photos in vivid color directly on glass. Go to fractureme.com. So, Fracture, these pictures are great. I have them all over my office. I just hung up a new one. The one that I sent you guys of us podcasting in the Macworld studio, just hung that up. I have Fractures everywhere. They're great. It is a rectangle or square with a photo printed right on it. And it's nice. It's like a nice, thin, lightweight piece of glass, photo printed on the backside of it, but it's thin, so it doesn't look like it's deep, you know. And then a little foam board piece behind it that you can mount screws onto to hang it up on the wall. And so it's just this all-in-one thing that it's not too heavy. You don't have to worry about it like ripping out of the wall and shattering. It's not too heavy. It looks amazing. You don't need a frame, you know, big heavy glass frame around it. It is its own frame. It is its own self-contained thing. And the prints look great. It's great for gifts. It's great for decorating your house. Great for decorating your office. I love them. As I said, we have them everywhere. We keep ordering more. They are great. Prices start at just $15 for a 5x5 square, and they're very reasonable after that. I have a couple of, like, I don't know, it's probably like 11x17 ish ones. I forget how much they were, but it was like a no brainer to just get them. It's really very good prices. Every Fracture is handmade and checked for quality by real people in Gainesville, Florida. It is the thinnest, lightest, and most elegant way to display your favorite photo. Now, I mentioned in previous sponsorships that one thing I did with Fracture is I would take that small 5x5 $15 size, and I would print out my app icons with it. It's great for Instagram photos and stuff. You know, it's a small square. But I would use it to make icons of the apps that I've made as kind of like a trophy to show these are the apps I've made. And so there I have this row of three of them up in my window or up above my windows here, and they look great. Well, ever since I've been talking about this, a few other people have started doing it. And Fracture is now, they're actually trying to collect pictures of all these things out there in the world. So they are hoping to build a gallery of these on their site. So here's what you do. Post if you have one of these things. First of all, if you don't have one, order one for any apps you make or have worked on. It's great. Also, good size for podcast artwork, because it's also square. Mm-hmm. Any kind of square artwork or rectangles. They can do rectangles. No big deal. Take a picture of your app icon Fracture print. And then post it on Twitter or Instagram with a photo of your app icon with the hashtag Fractured App, all one word, Fractured App on Twitter or Instagram. And then they will contact you to try to get your app in their gallery. So check it out. This is a cool idea, because I'll tell you what, it looks great. And it's a great use. $15. It's so cheap. And you can get even cheaper than that, because use coupon code ATP15 to get 15% off your first order. So go to fractureme.com, coupon code ATP15 to get 15% off your first order. Thanks a lot to Fracture for sponsoring our show once again.
Excellent. All right. So we are chipping away at the follow-up. What else do we have? We have a answer to my question about who supplies Tesla. That's right. So Sam, Abwelsamid, I'm so sorry, Sam, wrote in to say, Tesla designs and builds their own electric motors and power electronics, the part that does the DC to AC conversion, just as most automakers design and build their own engines. Transmissions tend to be a mixed bag of in-house and supplier produced for automakers today. The Model S brakes are supplied by Brembo, one of the few suppliers that are typically highlighted by automakers. And I think that's an excellent point. Other suppliers are highlighted on a chart, which we'll put on the show notes. Tesla designs and builds their own battery packs, but the 6,000 to 8,000 lithium ion cells in each pack are supplied by Panasonic. The Gigafactory, which we were talking about last episode, is actually a joint venture between Tesla, Panasonic, and a few other suppliers. So a little bit of information about that.
I think it says that Tesla makes the battery packs, but Panasonic makes the batteries. So I guess they make the pack part. I mean, I know it's, you know, the electronics and the complicated things over that, but that, you know, just goes to show, even it's like, oh, well, Tesla makes their own batteries. They're really good at it. They're still outsourcing the actual like bazillion little lithium ion cells that they wired together. Did you look at the big picture that I linked there?
I did not.
I did my homework.
All right.
I mean, just look at it. I mean, it's, and every car is like this. So it just shows that Tesla is more or less typical. You can go down the suppliers and see. I mean, this is not every single part in the car. It's just kind of like a sample of things. You could see also the front grille surround by our friends at Magna. You know, electric power steering, ZF. You know, Brembo brakes is a good point that, like, when something comes with Brembo brakes, you tend to see. Well, I don't know. I see it in car magazines, but car magazines also tell you. You know, who makes the transmission and the tires as well. But yeah, I guess they'll sometimes just advertise carbon ceramic brakes or whatever. I don't even think they offer carbon ceramic. Anyway, yes, it takes a village to make a car, including the Tesla.
Yep. All right. So further car feedback, this time from Yuba. I'd made mention of a bus that specifically was in Volkswagens in the context of the conversation we were having an episode or two ago. But Yuba had said in the U.S., CAN, which is the CAN bus, has been the standard protocol for all car computer communications since 2008, not just German cars. Some messages on the bus are standard and well-documented, such as speed, air intake, temperature, etc., but most are OEM-specific and undocumented, although they are unencrypted. Lots of people have reverse-engineered those messages to do things like lock or unlock their car doors, kind of the way Universal TV remote makers have to reverse-engineer infrared comms for each TV manufacturer. This kind of work is finicky and potentially harmful to your car, so you want to be careful. And this is interesting, and Yuba continues, what's cool, though, is that car manufacturers aren't interested in locking down the CAN bus, or at least they can't, because of a long legal tradition of people's right to repair their own cars. I thought that was really interesting and a very good point. And Yuba continues and says that this is what opens the door for companies like Automatic, which is a previous sponsor. And as it turns out, this individual is one of the co-founders to build awesome stuff using events read from the CAN bus. So I just thought that was really, really interesting and a little more information than I was aware of about all of that.
Yeah, I have the idea of it just, you know, having the bus be documented, but then they not under any obligation to document the things they send over the bus. So it's just a bunch of data going back and forth that you can kind of figure out. And it's like, that's like the worst of all possible words. Like, well, we have an open bus, but we're going to send messages over there and not document what they are. So you can try to figure out what they are, and I hope you get it right. And we might change it in the next version. I mean, I know it's not really like safety related things where they're going to turn off the power steering or power brakes accidentally or something, but it doesn't seem like an ideal situation, you know? Like, and again, the whole reason Automatic exists is because car manufacturers are so terrible. Like, there should not, this market need should not exist if car manufacturers had any idea what they were doing, because, you know, by the time a third party gets around to doing it, you could have done it as the car maker like a decade ago and didn't because you're terrible.
Yeah, and it's funny because I'm assuming it's the CAN bus that allowed me to do something that BMW owners called code the car, which is to say you get this like dongle that is similar to Automatic but serves a different purpose. But it's either a Bluetooth or a Wi-Fi dongle that you plug into your OBD2 port.
Nice.
Thank you. and so
mine's Ethernet.
Yeah, yours. That's right.
It's called an Ethernet cable, and it's like. It's literally like Ethernet on one end and OBD2 on the other,
which is really weird.
But and I've never used it. I try because like in order to use it, you have to like pirate all this software and all these like ROMs for the car and all this crazy stuff. And I just once I realized all the stuff I'd have to do in order to make little customizations to my car, I'm like, you know what? Forget it. Like it's not worth it.
See, that's what you get for buying a new car. But me, I bought an old and busted car. And what's nice about buying, it's not actually busted, but anyway, by buying a slightly older car, I was able to take one of these OBD2 to Wi-Fi converters, bridges, whatever. And then my uncle, who also has a BMW, has this $50 iPhone app, and you thought $10 was expensive, has this $50 iPhone app that connects to this thing and will let you make, like Marco said, some customizations to your car. So as a silly example, I'm able to open my windows from the little key fob, but I was not previously able to close them. I had to, oh, travesty of travesties, I had to stand outside the car and put my finger on the door handle in order to close all the windows.
Oh, God, you're an even bigger jerk than me.
It was so terrible, Marco. You have no idea.
This is great. Well, all I wanted to do was get, because like every time you start up the car, like most modern cars with navigation systems, you have to like hit the confirm or I agree button on a EULA on the license, on the nav screen before it will do anything. And there's like a little, you know, checkbox flag and these hack programs that you can turn that off. That was mainly what I wanted to do, was just disable that.
Right. So what I did was I coded my car such that I can hold the lock button on my key fob and all the windows will go up. And the only other thing I was interested in, but apparently it was a lot more fiddly, is on BMWs and a lot of car makes, the mirrors, the external mirrors can fold in if you push a little button. I think on most Mercedes, they're actually automatic. Well, I wanted it to be automatic so that every time I parked the car, the mirrors would fold in. But that was like many, many, many switches, and I got scared and I didn't do it. But I can roll up my windows from a distance, and that's awesome.
The only analogous story I have for my cars is that... like many people who have had stick shift cars before the time you guys are probably driving, I was forced to master the art of paying a toll with physical cash and then pulling away from the toll booth while rolling up the window, as in rolling up the window in a stick shift car, which basically leaves maybe thighs to steer with, but normally it's straight. So you got to give cash, roll up, first gear, pull away, roll, 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 and then hopefully the... Yeah. That's my equivalent.
I would just complete the roll up before going, like just sitting there with the gate open.
No, you got that's because I'm from New York. You don't sit there and the okay, now let me close up my purse and let me put it back down over here and let me roll up the window and now let me shift into gear. And no, it's not how it works. As soon as they get the money, as soon as that arm goes up, you've got to go.
Yep, I know that feeling.
Oh, there's a related link, by the way, on this CAN bus thing.
Yeah.
Well, now we're. Hang on, people. We're going to drift back into Apple and something else that is not car related. So this is our transition. The story that was going around at this Telegraph interview with Tim Cook, where he says that the Apple Watch is designed to replace your car keys, which is an interesting statement. And it could be related to CAN bus because it's like, all right, well, so that doesn't mean Apple's making a car. Designed to replace your car keys just means it has some way to signal to whatever fancy cars that Apple Watch, you know, like, does it work with the CAN bus? Is it some kind of wireless thing or reverse engineered thing where you can run an application that they can figure out that, you know, like car keys, this statement confused me because my understanding is that the silly proximity key stuff that every car maker has is all proprietary and crazy. And how could the Apple Watch replace your, like,
well, I'm sure all it is just using an app. It's like the watch is using a WatchKit app on the phone to, you know, because some of these car makers will have apps that can remotely unlock their cars. I'm pretty sure BMW does. I know Tesla does. I know I'm sure many of the car makers do this sort of thing now.
So is it Bluetooth or Wi-Fi or what is it?
No, it's neither. It's the watch telling the phone and the phone using the data network to go tell some data center to tell the car to unlock.
Oh, that's a hell of a long way to go. It's like the Rube Goldberg machine for, you know, I think I bounce a signal off a satellite and go to a fiber optic cable under the sea to a server and then come back to the car that's 2 feet in front of me.
I bet that's what it is, though. I would almost guarantee that's what it is.
Yeah, I didn't think of that, but you mentioned it. That sounds very plausible.
No, that is absolutely how the BMW app works. There's a BMW remote, which used to be okay and now is a piece of crap. But anyways, what that used to do is it would phone home to BMW, presumably in Munich, and say, I would like to unlock my car, please. Then Munich would phone the car because the car has a cellular connection for the quote-unquote OnStar, although in BMW's case, it's something proprietary. And then it would tell the car via the car's onboard cell connection, okay, unlock the door, please.
Our second sponsor this week is Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com and enter offer code ATP at checkout. Now, this past fall, Squarespace unveiled Squarespace 7, a major update, major redesign to their platform. It makes everything like crazy WYSIWYG. Like you are just always looking at your blog's layout and you can edit stuff anywhere you are. There's no more separation of like, here's your editing interface and here's your public interface. You're just editing the public interface. It's really crazy. I don't know how they were able to do all this. Well, the answer is a ridiculous amount of engineering resources, probably. But it's incredible what they've pulled off here, all in a web interface. So Squarespace 7 also has a bunch of other features, redesigned interface, as I mentioned, integration with Google Apps. They have a partnership with Getty Images where you can, for $10, you can just buy and have full license to a stock photo for anything, any part of your website, whether it's the logo, the background, an image in a blog post, whatever the case may be. They have a huge collection that you can search for from Getty and very high quality images if you need them, which is so much faster, easier, and cheaper than getting pro stock photography in any other way, really, that I've ever seen. They also have a bunch of new templates. They have this great cover pages feature where you can have a, it's like a splash page for your site, and you can put it up temporarily. It can have a whole different theme than the rest of your site, so you can use it for promo use if you want to. If you're doing some kind of special event, running a special deal, just made something new, you can do with that, or you can always have it up there, no big deal. Squarespace, as always, is beautiful, simple, and powerful. They have 24/7 support via live chat and email, and all this starts at just $8 a month. Really incredible deal. And again, everything's responsive design. This is all modern stuff. Your site will look modern and it keeps up to date. You don't have to worry about, like, you know, buying some really expensive theme from a designer today and then in 3 years it looks out of date. Like, Squarespace keeps it updated for you, and there's always new stuff to choose from. You can always, you know, it's always modern. Some new phone comes out, it always just works on the new phone. You know, some new device comes out, your site will just work. They have all sorts of iPhone apps as well you can do for all sorts of cool stuff for Squarespace. It is ridiculous how much they offer. They even have commerce. If you want to have a store on your site to sell digital or physical goods, they have all that built in, and there's no additional charge to use it. It's really an incredible set of functionality here. All this starting at just $8 a month. And you can see all of it for free with a free trial for, I believe it's 7 days, right? 7 day free trial? Doesn't matter, because you know what? When the trial ends, they just email you and they say, hey, you want to keep going? Just click this link and we'll extend it. No big deal. It's fantastic. Check it out, squarespace.com. Use coupon code ATP when you finally buy it to get 10% off your first purchase. Once again, squarespace.com, code ATP to get 10% off your first purchase. Really, it is incredible. Squarespace, start here, go anywhere, build it beautiful. I forget their current slogan. They have tons of great slogans. It's great. It's Squarespace, start here, go anywhere, build it beautiful, and it's fast and easy. Awesome.
All right. So that's it for follow-up, right? Anything else, John?
I was going to complain about, Tim Cook's statement with the car keys, but now that I read the actual article in the Telegraph, it says, the watch is designed to be able to replace car keys and the clumsy large fobs that are now used by many vehicles, comma, Cook told the Telegraph. So it's not a quote. There's no quotation marks there. I'm just relying on their summary. But what the hell does it mean to be designed to replace car keys? And so, like, what he maybe, I can't imagine Tim Cook ever saying that, or like, it's just terrible. Like, it's the type of thing that you would expect a CEO that doesn't actually know what their products are or do to say, not something that Tim Cook would say. But again, this is not a quote. This is just a summary. But anyway, your clarification about the pervasiveness of basically internet connections for dealing with car stuff leads me to believe that's probably what it is.
Yeah, it has to be.
That's kind of boring. But anyway, you know, the read on it, like, it's almost like Tim Cook is winking at us. Why mention that at all? You know what I mean? Why mention anything having to do with design to replace your car? Same kind of thing of, like, you know, he said, I use it to control my Apple TV. Well, that's a product they have at least. But why mention anything? Oh, by the way, it could replace car keys. Have you heard anything about cars lately? Anyway, moving on.
I mean, it also, you know, because, you know, it wasn't a direct quote, we aren't seeing the context. He could have just thrown that out there, like, in a list of things that could be done with it in software.
It could have been a leading question. Yeah, like, could it be used to replace car keys? And Tim says, yeah, sure. Yeah, well. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, it means nothing. It just means nothing.
I know. But it could be him winking at us. We don't know.
Probably not.
He's not a winker.
So maybe he'll be winking or not winking at us during the Apple event that's coming up on the 9th, which is Monday. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a daylight savings day.
Yeah, someone in marketing was excited to pick that date.
It's all about time because we're going to talk about a watch. It's about time. You get it?
The slogan on the invitation is spring forward.
I know. Right? Do you get it? Because watches used to have springs and it's daylight savings time joke and it's a watch. God. Oh my God. And it's springtime sort of somewhere maybe.
Yeah, right. They announced this date. When did they announce it? Like last month, but we didn't get a chance to talk about it because we were swamped with car stuff. But yeah, so what do we think about this event? I mean, the consensus is that it will be more information about watches. And what do you think? That's it?
Yeah, you know, we actually got a really interesting anonymous email about this that kind of hinted to us that maybe this will involve some sort of MacBook Air, a Retina MacBook Air, perhaps. And
yeah, the Mark Gurman Retina MacBook Air.
Right.
Basically. The 9-to-5 Mac, like, perfect, you know, nearly perfect outing of this thing. Yeah, that's allegedly, if this tip is to be believed, you know, I never really know what we're supposed to do when people email us tips.
I know, it's so true.
That's why I think talking about the tip is not as interesting as talking about the, like, why are we being sent tips and what's the point? And by the way, you know, just on the substance of this, did it actually say that this stuff would be announced in the event on the 9th?
Yes, it did.
Yes, it did.
Where is that? Where does it say that?
In the email. I did my homework, John.
I know. I read it when it came in. Where in the email, though?
Here's a brief preview of what's happening on Watch Day.
Oh, on Watch Day. All right. All right. Yeah. I mean, I suppose, like, there's enough room in the event to talk about new MacBook Air. And because, like, it's not that, like, they're announcing the watch. Even when they announced the watch, they had other stuff to announce. Here, they're just going to fill us in with details, we assume, like, any changes they might have, hopefully pricing info. They already gave us availability, right? We know the launch date, don't we?
Well, we just know the launch month of April.
Yeah, I guess they could pin it down to a day, but, like, you don't have a whole event. They're going to, you know, fill out the rest of the missing pieces and maybe announce when pre-orders are available and maybe show off the new redesigned Apple stores where you're going to be able to try these things on and buy them and do all that business. And I think there's enough room in a presentation that contains that to also talk about whatever new Mac thing they have to launch. And this supposed tip is telling us that the other thing they have to launch is a MacBook Air that we have discussed at length based on the 9-to-5 Mac rumors, and has a few extra tidbits to add. And before we talk about the actual substance, the idea that people, you know, send us an anonymous tip, why would somebody do that? Like, assume it's real. Assume this person actually knows. They're in a position to know or think they know because they're secondhand or thirdhand, and they totally believe all their sources. So as far as they're concerned, they're in possession of super secret information about what is shipping. Why send it to anybody? Why send it to Gruber? Why send it to us? Why send it to, you know, why do Mark Gurman's sources at 9-to-5 Mac send him information? That is mysterious to me. It's not like they're disgruntled employees trying to leak information to hurt their employer.
Well, sometimes. I mean, you should. There's a good discussion about this on Upgrade this week with Jason Snell and Mike Hurley, where they talked exactly about this. And Jason had a lot to say about, you know, why these sources say the things they say, who, you know, where their information might come from, why they're motivated to share it with somebody, you know, why you're motivated to publish it or to tell it. It's very interesting. So just go listen to that, because Jason knows a lot more about this than we do.
But I didn't listen to that one yet, so I don't know what he said, so you should tell me, because I might not know.
Well, the gist of his point is that, like, when you know this kind of secret information, like, it's a lot of people are very motivated. Like,
it's like burning a hole in your pocket. You just got to tell somebody because you're excited to know. But see, that's the worst kind of source, though, because if you're super excited to know this information, then it's not like a matter of course. Like, for the people who work at Apple on these projects, that's just part of their life, is you're going to know stuff that other people would like to know that you're never going to tell anybody. So the leaks would never come from there, because you're not like, oh my goodness, I know about this thing, I gotta tell some. No, that's your whole job. Like, you get used to it, like, or you get fired. Like, it has to be somebody who is not usually in the position to know what the super secret Apple product is, and then also be like, oh, I gotta tell somebody. And there's a separation inside Apple. It's like, well, every Apple employee doesn't know. There's something in the company that every Apple employee doesn't know about, because the only people who know about, like, the supposed car project are the people who are working on it. To everyone else, it could be like, oh, I'm not usually, but, you know, but you always know about your project, right? And so I guess that might kind of get old. So, but anyway, second or third tier people who, like, heard from someone and are super excited to know this, it's depressing to think that, like, they're just excited to tell somebody, because obviously if they're excited, they're probably an Apple fan. And in general, you know, Apple doesn't want people knowing these things. So,
right. And it kind of spoils the surprise too. Like, for the rest of the fans, like, it's kind of ruins the fun if you know everything that's going to happen before it's out.
And Apple wouldn't like it. It's like, they're such Apple fans. You know, back when Steve Jobs was alive, if you have to put a person's name on it, it's like, what would Steve think about you telling these sites this information that you know? Would he, like, if you ever met him, go, oh my God, I'm a big fan. In fact, I leaked this information. Like, no, he would shoot you with his lasers out of his eyes and you would melt. Like, if you admire the company and admire the people who work there, that seems like it's the reason the people who don't leak, the people who work there, don't leak, because it's out of respect for the company and for what they do. And, you know, like, I don't know. It's weird.
I've had like people send me tips, like ever since I started writing my site forever ago. I've had tips come in here and there by email, and I get the most boring tips. Like, it is hilarious. It's like, yeah, well, you know, next year they might update the cinema display. Wow.
That would be a good tip if you get that one. Tell me.
I haven't for a long time, actually.
Right. Every year, it's like, I should send you the same tip. No new monitor this year. Go back to sleep.
Yeah, but like, you know, but I don't like, in the tips I've gotten, I have not mentioned almost any of them, because it's like, what am I supposed to do with this information? Like, if I just publish it on my site, like, there's lots of rumor sites that just publish any tips they get. They're usually the worst rumor sites, because most of, like, if I look back at the tips I've gotten, I would say at least half of them have not panned out or have turned out to be just flat out wrong. If I had published anything or based anything I'd said on that information, I would have looked stupid. I would have looked bad. And I'm happy to say that of all the crazy tips, of all the crazy predictions I've made on my site over the years that have turned out to be wrong, like blatantly, embarrassingly wrong, almost none of them were based on any tips I've gotten. I just am that bad at predicting things. But I, at least that's me screwing up and you know, with my own guesses, and not like, oh, I got this crazy tip, I better rush and report on it on my site. Because like, no one's coming to my site for that anyway. What, like, I stand to gain nothing from that. And the chances that that any tip I get are actually going to be true are so low that it's just not really worth discussing. Like, it's not worth even taking the risk.
I think when Mark Gurman was on the talk show, I think what he mentioned is that his, I may be misremembering this, but his best sources were people that he actually knew, like anonymous sources. This is the kind of email we get. Someone went to our web form and typed a bunch of stuff. Anybody could just go to that web form and type stuff. All you got to do is just sound confident and say, look, this is what they're going to do. There's this, there's that, you know, you can say whatever you want. Anybody can go to that form. Like, you know, anybody who listens to the show now could come up with a plausible rumor and type it in confidently into our web form. That's the type of source that, like, it's basically useless because you don't know who that person is, and anybody could, we're about to discuss what this person emailed us, but anybody could have, I could have written this email. Like, it's only impressive after the fact if what Apple announces is exactly what was in this email, then we'll retroactively know, oh, that one anonymous email, that guy was exactly right. But that doesn't help us when the next anonymous email comes in, because we don't know if it's from the same guy. Like, it's, you know, I think you really have to have, you have to know who you're talking to, and you have to know how they know the things they know, and how it's plausible, and have like a track record with them, so that, you know, this one guy I'm talking to has been right three times in a row, and the fourth thing that he says, maybe I'll believe. And even then, they could still be gaming you and try to suss out leaks or who the hell knows what. But yeah, it's like, it's confusing to me when someone sends something like this, because the only kind of inside information I'm ever comfortable receiving, not that I really receive any to speak of, is the type of information told to me with the understanding that I will never tell anyone. And then I do never tell anyone. And that's it. That's where it ends. And this is the, like, for the purposes of the outside world, it is useless. It's exciting to me because now I know something that very few people know, but then I never tell anyone else. And then, you know, like, oh, well, you know, I mean, it helps. I guess it helps me. Sometimes I get told things in confidence, sort of for the purposes of background information for my OS X reviews and stuff like that. And that informs my reviews and occasionally helps me to be right about things that I had no right to be exactly right about, that I just happened to actually know. But I never phrase it as I'm 100% sure about this, even when I am 100% sure about it, because that's not the point. I'm not trying to like reveal secrets or show how much inside knowledge I have. Even if I know for sure something, I'm going to phrase it as this is something that is plausible. And I say the same thing about other things that I have no inside information about, equally phrased with the same amount of confidence. This is plausible, like technically feasible, plausible, could be, blah, blah, blah. Half of the could be's are just like Marco, or I'm just making stuff up and thinking, well, this could happen. We'll see. And the other half are like, I know for sure this is exactly what it is, but I'm never going to tell you that or how I know that. So just, you know, and anyone reading it, it's not a secret code. You can't decode it. It's just a bunch of things that could be plausible. Some of them turn out to be true. Some of them turn out to be false. But that's the only thing I can understand, because those people would talk to you because they want an accurate picture of like their product or their technology or whatever to be out there in the world in a way that doesn't impinge secrecy. I can't imagine someone telling me something and saying, now you're free to go write that about this on your blog. Like, that dynamic is weird to me, especially in an ongoing basis, that there would be someone with inside information that routinely gives information to someone who they know and consent to publish that information on their blog as confidently asserting this is information we have from inside Apple.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, like what you said, like when we are told things in confidence that we are expected to really not share because it would, you know, put somebody in a bad spot that we might know, that I actually feel like that's kind of more fun to me, like to have a secret that I'm not expected to do anything with, that I'm actually really expected not to write about or share.
Because yeah, that's why they told you, the understanding that you're never going to tell anybody. And maybe they tell you, like, for example, for you, someone might tell you something that influences which API you choose to use or something, because it helps you with your job, right? But it's not something you're going to go on your blog and go, hey, guys, guess what? You should use this API, not this one, because reasons X, Y, Z. Like, the only reason the person told you is because they're telling you, not so. Like, they understand that you are not going to post it on your site because your site is not a clearinghouse for inside information that you get from Apple.
Right. And you know, when people tell me things that may or may not be true, I usually have no way to know. But when people tell me things that may or may not be true, you know, you're right. Like, the best thing it can do really is to inform my future thoughts and actions and discussions on the show or on my blog. Like, it's really better in that way, because then, like, you avoid all the risks of what if you're wrong, or what if you get somebody in trouble or burn some trust. But you can benefit from, like, you know, if you heard from somebody in Apple that this thing that you were saying before actually is wrong, you can stop saying it. or like, you know, you can, next time you comment on an issue, you can be better informed about it. Or as you said, like, you know, when you're trying to make a decision between, you know, the product in the lineup, like, oh, should I buy a Mac Mini right now? No, wait. Then, like, you know, stuff like that. Or should I use Core Data for this? Should I use iCloud, Cloud Sync or whatever? And you can make those kind of decisions. That is better than just spewing out a secret for whatever brief value it might have to you that might backfire.
And we're more likely to get information from people who are sort of the leaf nodes in the organizational graph at Apple. And those people only know what they know, but none of those people know what products Apple's going to ship, what those products are going to be called, when they're going to be released, how much they're going to cost. Like, nothing, you know, all they know is, like, what they see at their, from their perspective on their project. And nobody, not even inside the Apple, knows the future. Projects are canned, projects are canceled, projects are delayed, things change. Like, so even that information, even though it could be 100% reliable, that's what the entire company thought at the time you got that information. But it turns out they changed priorities and did this and did that, and this thing got moved to there, and this project was canceled, and this person left the company. And then it turns out that nothing they told you comes true. Not because they were wrong, or, you know, just because, like, that was the plan at the time, but plans change. And so, like, that's why when I look at these rumor sites, I'm like, even if this is 100% true, it still doesn't predict the future in a way that is useful, because things change so much on whatever detail that they've just put out here.
I don't know. I feel like I can understand a perspective where what if this person, or a person, is an Apple employee but happens to like our show, and maybe they admire any one or all three of us, and maybe they want to kind of participate in the show a little bit without necessarily doing so by name. So they have a little bit of pertinent and perhaps interesting information, and they could give it to the three of us and probably steer the show in the direction of that information, such as what this person has done in getting us to talk about secrets in general. And then you can sit back and you can know, I did that. I was the one who got the three of them to talk about that. And look at me. I am an informant now. I'm special to people I think are special.
Well, I think it's more likely to be excited by the fact that I just made up a bunch of BS and they talked about it on the show as if it was real. Because that is what I think when I see an anonymous email. It's like, oh, if we talk about this on the show, the guy's going to be like, I can't believe they talked about that. Me and my friends just made this up and typed it in a web form. Because again, it's all plausible. It's all 100% plausible. Anybody can make up a plausible rumor. You just got to assert it confidently and then you just wait. And so this is why I wanted to talk about it, because this will be bringing the audience in on what this is like on a micro scale, where we're going to talk about what they say in this prediction, and then we can all find out, was this just totally bogus stuff that somebody made up, and haha, we're suckers for talking about it, or was it, my God, we didn't know it at the time, but it's 100% accurate, and we'll all find out together. So
the really funny thing about this is that the extra info that we allegedly have that no one else allegedly has is so boring.
But it's all stuff that we talked about. Like when we talked about this stuff, we talked about pretty much all of these possibilities, but we just talked about them as a sea of possibilities. They could do this or they could do that. Let's talk about the pros and cons of this, or what if they did that? Like we've covered all of these bases before. What this rumor, what this supposed tip is doing is saying, all those possibilities you listed, this is the one that's real and this is the one that's happening and here's why. And I guess there's a little bit of a here's why angle here. So we'll find out together.
But first, our final sponsor.
Oh, nicely done.
Our final sponsor this week, after which we will tell you our top secret information. I'm laughing at what it is because I know it. Like, oh, it's so great. All right. Our final sponsor this week is Harry's. Go to harrys.com, H-A-R-R-Y-S. Use promo code ATP to save $5 off your first purchase. Harry's offers high-quality razors and blades for a fraction of the price of the big razor brands. It was started by two guys who wanted a better product without paying an arm and a leg. Harry's makes their own blades from their own factory. This is an old blade factory that they actually bought in Germany. These are high-quality, high-performing German blades crafted by shaving experts, giving you a better shave that respects your face and your wallet. Harry's offers factory-direct pricing at a fraction of the big brand's prices. Now, Harry's blades, they run about, by my calculations, about half the price, sometimes a little bit less, of things like the Gillette Fusion blades. Plus, you don't have to wait around. Buying blades at a store is such a terrible experience these days, because now, like, all the drugstores have those anti-shoplifting cases, and you have to like wait around for some guy to come over with the key, and it's just so stupid. With Harry's, it's just all online, free delivery most of the time. I think it's free shipping anyway. Really cheap at any rate. It's so much better with Harry's. You just order online. They have automatic delivery with subscriptions, or you can buy them manually. No pressure. It's great. The starter set is an amazing deal. So for $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shave cream or gel, your choice, and three razor blades. When you need more blades, they run about $2 each or less. An 8-pack is $15. A 16-pack is $25. And I would say, based on my experience with Harry's blades, they are, I would say, equal in quality to the Gillette Fusion non-ProGlide blades. The ProGlide ones are a little bit slipperier, but the Harry's blades, I would say, are identical in shave quality to the Fusion blades. For reference, the best price on Amazon for Fusion blades is a 12-pack for about $40. And Harry's blades are $20 for 12. So really, it is like half the price of and just as good a quality. And the handles are way nicer. The handles are like these nice, like weighty metal handles, much better designs. You know, none of this like goofy, like robot blue strip design. Like it's so classy, so nice. It's awesome. With Harry's, you get the convenience and ease of ordering online, high quality blades, a great handle and shaving cream, and excellent customer service if you ever need it. All this at half the price of the big brands. So get started today with a set that includes a handle, three blades, and shaving cream for just $15 shipped to your door. And if you use promo code ATP, you get $5 off your first purchase. Go to harrys.com, promo code ATP. Thanks a lot to Harry's.
Okay, so before we talk about the contents of this, maybe it's real, maybe it's not, rumor/tip.
Get excited, everyone.
We should probably talk about what the original rumor was that Mark Gurman and crew posted at 9 to 5 Mac.
Yeah, we didn't talk about this enough when it came out.
Well, just a very quick recap. So they had said that there's going to be a radically new 12-inch MacBook Air, and more importantly than almost anything, that it was going to do away, well, let me read, a radically new design that jettisons standards such as full-sized USB ports, MagSafe connectors, and SD card slots in favor of a a thinner and lighter body with a higher resolution display. So that was the basis of all of these rumors. So with that in mind, John, would you like to take us through what this individual has said to us?
Yeah, there's only a couple of pieces here. The first part is about the trackpad that I think it's in that article that we discussed that, like, you know, the thing's going to be so thin that the trackpad has no place to sort of click down into. So the idea was that the trackpad will not actually move when you click it. And we discussed, like, how are they going to handle that? How is it going to feel to press something that doesn't actually move? This anonymous tip person, and again, I would say we're not going to make a habit of reading anonymous tips, but I think it's fun just to do it in this one place so we could all find out together, was this totally bogus made-up stuff, or was it all 100% accurate? And I imagine that it's going to be one or the other extreme and not anywhere in the middle. Anyway.
It always is.
Yeah. This tip says that what they're actually using is the same thing they use for the Force Touch. No, not the Star Wars thing, but on the Apple Watch.
That's a reference, Casey.
Oh, I got it.
Where you press really hard on the Apple Watch and it can tell the difference between that and like a regular tap. That, you know, what this person says, Force Touch technology, I guess it's probably a branding thing or whatever, to tell the difference between a tap and a deep press. And the idea
sounds kind of creepy.
The idea that is that it will be better than, like, I know a lot of people who are devotees to tap to touch, tap to click on the trackpads, but the people who don't like it usually don't like it because it's easy to accidentally tap sometimes because, you know, just sort of any finger brushing against the trackpad counts as a click and you don't want that to happen. Well, this supposedly would make it much less ambiguous when you are clicking and when you're not. Still without a trackpad that actually moves, but so that the trackpad can tell a difference between you just sort of tapped your finger lightly on the pad and you are actually pressing, even though the thing doesn't move.
See, this, I'm a little skeptical. If they, I mean, it makes sense, you know, like it's plausible that this is what they might be doing. But because none of us have actually done Force Touch on a watch yet, like, I don't know, like, if you have to push hard at all, it's going to be really tedious and ergonomically questionable.
I don't think you have to press hard. I think the thing is a misnomer. My guess is that it's figuring out how much your finger squishes. So like the contact patch changes size. Mm-hmm. And I would assume that that's what the trackpad is using to determine the force, not like actual pressure. Or maybe it's a combination of both. But I don't think it's going to be like you'll be able to tell, I guess, if you take something that does not make a larger contact patch when you press and see if you can force touch with that. I don't know what that would be. Maybe some kind of like cylindrical hot dog in a sleeve or something that is like water. You know, you need something that's filled with water like the human finger and press with it in a way that the contact patch does not change size. And so maybe it's a combination. But you're right. None of us have tried the Force Touch on the watch. So telling us that the trackpad is going to be just like the watch almost tells us nothing at this point.
By the way, for whatever it's worth, I actually, when the Apple Watch was announced 6 months ago and they talked about Force Touch, I had speculated on the show they were probably just measuring the radius of the touch, you know, like capacitively, not actually measuring force. And I think we got a couple of people who sent it. I'm not remembering exactly, but I think we got a couple of people telling us there actually were pressure sensors as well. So I think there's something there, but either way, you know, we'll see how this pans out in practice. I was very skeptical of the current kind of tripods we have, the quote buttonless, where like kind of the whole thing is a button and just hinges on the top. I was very skeptical of that when it came out, and it turned out to be just fine and normal. So you know, this sounds really weird, but it might be awesome. I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, and there is a thing on the Apple Watch page, the Apple Watch technology page at apple.com. where you can see an explanation of Force Touch, and that's what we're being pointed to see. That explanation also applies to the thing. Again, with branding, Apple can apply the Force Touch. You know, once they have a sort of a branded name with a capital F and a capital T, then they can just apply that same name to anything remotely like that in their product line, regardless of whether it actually uses the same technology.
Retina.
Retina's not. What's a good example they've done that? I mean, FileVault and FileVault 2, which are totally unrelated technologies, other than the fact that they both attempt to encrypt your data. Implementation-wise, they share nothing, but they do share the same branding. So the next bit is about, like, what are they going to do if they have just a single port? How do they deal with that? And
this is the big one, guys. This is it.
The answer...
Are you ready?
The answer is super exciting. A USB hub. I know you're super excited about a USB hub. Now, the interesting part about this is not so much...
This is our tip, a USB hub.
Yeah, not so much the fact that they have a hub, but the this tipster... provides motivation behind this, and the motivation and little story behind it is with the original Retina MacBook Pro that didn't have an Ethernet port. Apparently, doing market research let Apple determine that people really want high speed networking if they're going to buy a big expensive laptop, and so they made the Thunderbolt to Ethernet adapter or whatever. Yep. According to this tipster, that was made, the sole reason that product existed was because of a customer demand that they discovered through market research, and that they were selling it either at cost or below cost when it was initially made, because at that point I assume Thunderbolt chips were expensive or whatever, because it was important for them to have that product. So the $29 adapter, unlike so many other Apple products, did not have a big margin. In fact, may have been sold at a slight loss when it was brand new. Now I'm sure the margins are better on it or whatever. So that same idea is with this adapter, like that they, you know, why does this hub exist? Well, because based on market research or whatever, determine that one port is not enough for people and they need some way to have other ports. And as Marco has talked about in past shows, third-party USB hubs are flaky and Apple probably doesn't want them to be attached to have to deal with like sleep-wake problems and things, you know, tickling the bus and stuff like that. So, and as I suggested, like it would be nice if Apple made a really nice sturdy port that they are sturdy USB hub that they knew worked with their stuff that like, maybe this is like a taller order if you currently have some Apple branded hardware that's driving you insane. It didn't help that it's made by Apple. It's still driving me nuts. Like a time capsule that's flaky or something. But anyway, in theory, Apple can make one of these, qualify it for use in all its OSs and make sure it's sturdy and good and all that good stuff. So according to this tipster, that is exactly what they're doing. They're making a hub. There's two USB type A ports, two type C ports. It's supposedly small and fairly heavy so that it doesn't get pulled off the table by the thing that you plug it in, because I assume it will be a powered hub.
See, that part sounded weird to me. A number of things about this sound weird to me. The fact that it's a small USB hub that's going to be heavy, that I don't buy that. And also, how funny is it? And it is very Apple-like, really, but how funny is it to make a USB hub that only has like four ports and only two of them are actually normal?
Well, like when I'm thinking of heavy, I'm thinking kind of like the Apple TV, like where it's dense for its size. Like, not that you think it's going to be a big, but it's small, but it feels dense when you pick it up. And it's probably like a grippy rubber thing on the bottom. I'm picturing something that looks like a little miniature white Apple TV when I see this. What do they say about this? Something about it having a short, stubby, stiff cable. Where is that bit?
The hub is small. The cable connecting it to the Mac is stiff and very short. It has a significant weight to it, so it doesn't get ripped off your desk or out of the port by the power brick.
See, power brick makes me feel bad. I don't like power bricks. Like, that's one of the annoying things about hubs is the stupid power brick, you know, the AC-DC converter and the little DC thing plugs in the back. That's one of the awesome things about the amazing things about the Apple TV. This is the one that has this, right? No internal power supply, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a little puck. And it does not have a power brick at all. It just has a plug that goes into, you know, the outlet. No, the power supply is internal, which is an amazing feat for such a tiny little thing. And I like that. And that's sort of like a sort of a premium experience. I don't know if the other pucks are like that. Like, you got the Amazon Fire TV now, right, Marco?
Yeah, it has a brick.
Yeah, and isn't it bigger than the Apple TV too, or close?
I think it has a bigger footprint, but it's pretty short. I think it's shorter but wider.
Right, and so if you took what's in that brick and added it to the volume of the Amazon thing, suddenly it would be huge. It just goes to show what Apple has done with their puck, despite the fact that everything else about their puck is completely outdated and outclassed by every other product in the category. They do have a really nice internal power supply. You got to give them that, right?
And no fan.
Yes, no fan. Love it. But the Amazon doesn't have a fan either, right?
As far as I know, it doesn't.
That's not a no.
Oh God!
I don't think it has any ventilation holes.
It's just got a fan, but no ventilation holes. It just spins in there. Churns around the warm air.
Oh, Jeff Bezos is a little bit crazy.
Yeah, and so the summary of this is that basically the Gurman report is completely accurate, and the only things that he didn't have was he didn't have the hub, and he didn't know whether it would be Retina. And the answer is yes, it will be Retina, right?
And by the way, Mark Gurman in a podcast like a few days after this did say, of course it'll be Retina. I don't know why he left that out of the article. Maybe he wasn't positive.
Well, he said high resolution.
But he specifically said, like, a few days later, like, yeah, of course it'll be Retina.
You know, he does run that website, or, like, can't he just go change it? He could have, like, once everybody said, you didn't even say it'll be Retina, you can just go right up to the thing and do update. Yes, it will be Retina. Close. Anyway.
Maybe he didn't know it for sure at the time that he published it and wanted everything in it to be correct, so that people would look back and say, wow, you got everything correct.
Yeah, so how could you have come up with this fake rumor if you had no information other than reading that Gurman article? It's pretty easy, because you could say that article is 100% correct, but there's two bits of information you don't know. One, I'm going to take that force touch thing that they already talked about for the watch and tell you that's how they're doing the trackpad. And two, everyone has been saying that if it only has one port, it'll be a problem. Maybe they'll have some kind of hub or something. Well, actually, Apple is making a hub, and here's how many ports will be on it, and here are a few attributes of it.
By the way, real-time follow-up on that Apple Watch technology page. Apple says right there that Force Touch uses tiny electrodes around the flexible Retina display to distinguish between a light tap and a deep press. Apparently there are actually hardware sensors that will attempt to detect a pressured press there, rather than just measuring the size of your fingertip growing bigger.
Or if it does that at all, maybe it doesn't do the fingertip radius at all. We don't know, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, we will find out, I suppose. I mean, how will we know whether this person was right? Well, first, Apple's got to have a USB hub, right?
Yeah. I mean, the USB hub that this email described, you know, that was a pretty thorough description. So like, it's going to be pretty obvious whether this was credible or not, because, you know, it's not like, you know, this event is 5 days from now. It's too late for something like this to be canceled. You know, like if this person wrote to us, I think this morning, right? So like, you know, chances are like this is either going to be 100% right or 100% wrong. There's not going to be some last minute change that, oh, well, I was right, but they delayed the iPad Pro. So, you know, no, it's not going to be like that. Like this is going to either be all right or all wrong. And I think it's hilarious that if it's all right, that we got this amazing tip about a USB hub.
And so the Force Touch thing, we have no way to tell whether that's right, because even if they don't use the phrase Force Touch, this doesn't tell us that they're going to use the phrase, the marketing term Force Touch. Like basically it's relying entirely on the Gurman article being right, because the Gurman article said trackpad that doesn't move. If it has a trackpad that doesn't move, was this one right? No, all it was doing is repeating. Like the only additional information it's providing is it's using the same thing as Force Touch. And we can't tell that when they announce it, because, you know, unless Apple specifically brands it with Force Touch, it's like, oh, well, trackpad doesn't move. That's what Mark Gurman already said.
Wait, guys, I have breaking news. I've just gotten a tip from an anonymous source that Apple's about to announce during this event an update to the AA battery charger.
Good God. Oh, you're the worst. Yeah, if this is real, and I'm not saying it is, but if it is real, and this person was genuinely excited to kind of quietly get credit for some, well, I think it's at least mildly interesting piece of information that nobody else really knew up front, I feel bad for this person, because we've now spent the last half an hour eviscerating this poor person.
No, I mean, like, you know, like if they're making it up, they deserve to be ridiculed. And if they're not making it up, they will be vindicated by history. Like, so that's why I'm trying to that's why I'm trying to figure out how we'll tell whether they're right. The most interesting thing, if this is true, the thing that I'm most interested about is the idea that Apple makes products and then does market research to figure out if the products are palatable and then scrambles to make adapters when they're not. That is, like, if that is actually true, that sort of, you know, and we don't have a good way to tell that, but like if inside Apple, that's how things are working, that is not a healthy situation, because that's what it gets back to my thing with the whole one port. Like, what advantage does one port provide that two port does not? And I haven't got a satisfactory answer. And if the answer is someone says, this is the product we're making, no, it's going to be thin, no Ethernet, no single port, blah, 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 and then some other department gets in and says, our customers are saying basically it's a no-go, so we got to give them some solution. Oh, I guess we'll make some adapters, slap it on, sell it at a loss. Like, that's terrible. It shows you're not making, like, it shows your product design is not fitting the market. And it would explain a lot of the things where they make something and then the next version, like, has more of a different kind of port or rearranges things or adjusts, you know, like, it's better to find this out ahead of time. You know, if you're going to do something, like, either stick to it or don't stick to it. Don't make a product and then slap a bunch of ugly adapters on it, because that is not an elegant, simple, clean, blah, 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 whatever Johnny Ive White World solution, right?
It's so true, because every time I go to give a presentation at work or plug my computer into the projector for any reason whatsoever, anytime I do that and have to get out the little Thunderbolt to VGA adapter, every PC user around the table just kind of shakes their head and snickers, like, because every single one of them has this antiquated VGA port, which is very useful, built into their computers and has since the beginning of time.
Yeah, well, they're wrong on that thing, because no one should have a VGA port on their computer. Like, if they have HDMI directly into their computer, or, like, you know, like, VGA is ridiculous. Give me a break. That should not be it. But sometimes you have to have an adapter, right? But for things like this, it's not like when you have to interact with some cruddy old third party thing, use this adapter. This is like when you want to use your computer for something that requires more than one port, use this hub that we're selling you. Or I know that you buy a Retina MacBook Pro and you're going to be using it on Ethernet every second you can because you need high speed networking. Use this dongle. You know, because we couldn't fit an Ethernet port. And sometimes, you know, they're limited by the size of the ports, so the Ethernet just doesn't fit. We want to make it thinner. Like, there are reasons for it, but especially with the single USB Type-C, like, the whole point of Type-C is it's super small. Now you can fit more of them. Don't give me fewer. Unless giving me fewer provides some advantage, as we talked about at length in the previous shows, like, oh, you can use fewer PCI Express lanes, or you get more battery life because you can use a chipset that doesn't include this thing, and I would like a reason, and based on random spy shots, we don't have any kind of reasoning. And of course, Apple's not going to give you any reasoning, probably, unless they're feeling super defensive. Like, if they're feeling defensive, they'll say, and hey, look at this feature, like Steve Jobs would say, it's just got one port. Now, people would say, why one port? Well, it turns out, and then he would say something that may or may not be true, but at least it would be a reason, you know? Turns out that if we just do one port, we can make an even lower power. And then, you know, other people with this, using the same Intel chipset are already released laptops. They get insane battery life, and I bet they don't have one port on them. So I'm going to be skeptical of any sort of power-related explanations of why this thing has one port, if it indeed does have one port.
I think the most clear explanation, or the most plausible explanation, knowing modern Apple and seeing the renderings of this thing from Mark Gurman, I think it's just thinness. That's it. Like, there was room for one.
But that I need to see the iFixit teardown to prove to me that there was really only room for one, right?
Right, and nobody asked him to make it that thin. You know, like, this is it's a self-imposed problem.
It's not because it's too thin. It's not like, well, there's only one part of the case that's thick enough. At minimum, there's two places on the case where it's thick enough, one on one side and one on the other. You know what I mean?
Right, like, well, but they use the other one for the headphone jack.
I know, but the headphone jack is, you could move, like, the headphone jack doesn't have a lot of width, so you could have the USB. Anyway, I feel like there's room. Not because, you know, within the case that they have now, when they open this thing up, I feel like you're going to be able to find that, yes, there was room. Again, get back to the puck thing where they put an internal power supply. There's got to be room in there for more than one port. Got to be. And so there's got to be some other reason, and it could be philosophical and stupid or whatever. But anyway, if the idea that they would subsequently do market research and determine this product is not as viable as they want it to be without an adapter, therefore we have to make a hub. Ugh, like, when that happens, it had to happen early on, right? Because you have to make this whole hub product. Like, shouldn't they go back and say, should we make a hub, or can you just put another damn port on this thing, guys? I mean, come on.
I mean, and for whatever it's worth, like, you know, now, like, I'm considering buying one of these things, because I keep realizing that whenever I travel, I hardly ever actually get, like, coding work done that actually needs a big screen real estate, and I actually would like smaller travel weight. Anyway, so I'm considering getting one of these things, and because I've had such terrible experiences with hubs and third-party adapters and everything, knowing that Apple is going to make an adapter, you know, if this proves to be true, this would make me more comfortable buying the laptop. Like, if the rationale that this person stated about, like, you know, making people more comfortable buying it being the reason these things exist, that is plausible to me, because I am one of those people who that is the case for.
Is there anything that's new that you cannot justify buying?
No. No, there's a lot. I mean, you know, like, I'm sure I can think of something eventually.
I've got one. It's an easy one. He has a TV that really needs to be replaced, but he doesn't replace it.
Yeah, that's a great example. Yeah, because it still works, and I don't care that strongly. Like, all the advantages of modern TVs that have come out since my relatively ancient one, you know, mine is still good. It's fine. You know, like, and after seeing yours at your house, John, like, came home and mine looked really small and really low contrast and you know, really crude by comparison, but it's still fine. You know, there's lots of stuff. I mean, look, this is going to replace, if I get this, this is going to replace a 3-year-old laptop. So it's not that ridiculous.
Oh, I didn't realize it was that old. All right, I feel better.
Yeah, it's a first-gen 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro with bad screen retention issues.
So I've heard. Okay, so before we end the show, let's talk quickly about the post you made with regard to Apple Watch pricing.
Thanks a lot to our three sponsors this week.
Listen to this
Fracture,
guy.
Squarespace, and Harry's, and we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin. 'Cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him. 'Cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYL. ISS, so that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse, it's accidental.
Read the damn Skype IMs. Two of the three parties in this podcast agreed to talk about this and then in the show.
We're still going to talk about it. He just wanted to be in the after show.
Yeah, I'm so bored of Apple Watch price discussion, which is why I wrote this big article for some reason.
Can we complain about how I already complained about this to you privately? Complain about how, yeah, all right. So this is, instead of complaining, let's turn it into a positive. Listeners to this show, if you are a regular listener to this show, I feel like that you are sometimes several weeks ahead of the press cycle on the Apple news sites, because when the Apple Watch was announced and talked about, we spent like three freaking shows talking about the price of the watch, whether it would be upgradable, how Apple's going to sell it in the stores. And then in the past 2 weeks, all of those topics came back with a vengeance on every single site where everyone is talking about, will the watch be upgradable? How much will it cost? How are they going to sell it in the stores? Which I think is fine, but it meant that like we weren't going to talk about it because we spent so long. You think we spent a long time talking about the car? Go back and see how long we talk about watch pricing and upgradability. It seemed like it was forever. And we just covered it from every possible angle and talked to ourselves to death. And there's no new information about it. Like, we haven't learned anything new about it. But, yeah, so to see all those things go back around a cycle and feel like we're not participating in that. I guess it's like the podcast cycle is different than the blog cycle or whatever. But yeah, Marco's pricing post, like, there's no, like, unless, correct me if I'm wrong, there's no new information, right? You're just rehashing pricing stuff, like, and sort of people are getting different feelings as the date approaches. Like, I know we talked about this before, and I know before I said X, but now I'm feeling like Y, and not based on any information, right? Like, you don't have any new information about price.
Oh, me? No, definitely not. The few people I've talked to inside of Apple have only provided their own speculation. Like, they don't know either.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, you know, as the date approaches, maybe you get a different feeling and maybe you want to hedge or maybe you want to stick to it, but we'll endeavor to find the links to the shows many moons ago when we talked about these things just forever. So people can go back to listen to them and to see how right or wrong we were after the Apple event, but we were right or wrong a long time ago. But for the rediscussion of it, I think the new angle that you had on it, Marco, was the idea of, previously we were talking mostly about, boy, can you believe how much these things are going to cost? Do we really think they're going to sell something for 10, 20, 30 grand at the top end or whatever? And the new angle is, how maybe they're going to cost way less than we thought. And as I was messaging to Marco earlier today, I think this is getting muddled up in the idea of, like, are you talking about how much will the most expensive Apple Watch Edition cost? Or are you talking about what is the cheapest price that you can get an Apple Watch Edition for? And depending on what you're talking about, like, you could agree that the Apple's going to sell one for 10 grand or 20 grand. And you can also agree that the cheapest one will be like 2,000, 3,000. Like, those are not incompatible ideas because there can be a wide range in the Apple Watch Edition thing. And so the new thing is like, oh, maybe we're just all being crazy. And maybe the Apple Watch Edition will only be like $1,200, $1,500, $2,000, $3,000. I'm willing to believe that. But that won't mean that you still can't get the most expensive Apple Watch Edition with a gold, solid gold band and a solid gold watch and all this other stuff for 10, 15 grand, even if you can also get one for 5 grand, 4 grand, 6 grand or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point. I mean, because we still don't know, like, the variability within each line, like, depending on the band choice and everything else. Like, that's, well, there's no everything else, depending on the band choice and the size.
Especially because if the band is solid gold itself, that the band could contain way more gold than the watch.
Actually, yeah. I mean, I don't know anything about watches, but that makes logical sense to me.
Like, volume wise, I mean, I guess I don't know how strong they're, like, whatever, super strong gold alloy, whatever. We don't know. Obviously, we know nothing about watches, but just looking volume wise, it's conceivable to me that having a gold band could more than double the price of the watch versus just that same watch with a leather one. And as we talked about in the past shows, again, I don't want to rehash everything we did. The price of the materials has very little bearing when you're up in this type of class of product, very little bearing on the price of the product. The markup can be astronomical. It's not like a 30% margin. It's like hundreds of a percent margin. You know, how high can you possibly go? And the only thing stopping you is, like, it is basically like a social and economic signal, not a reflection of the cost to manufacture or acquire the, you know, the materials to make.
Yeah, and you know, keep in mind also, like, the manufacturing of these things is a big deal. Like, they talked about on the description on the Apple Watch site, and I don't know if it's on the site or if it's in the video, but somewhere in official Apple material, they talk about how each link is, like, hand polished, and it takes like 6 hours to make one of these things. Like, if that has 6 hours of labor in it, that's going to cost significantly more than the cost of the raw metal. not to mention the, you know, the machining and any parts that might have to be discarded and recycled. Like there's going to be a lot behind that. So like the fixed cost of the gold watch is going to be substantially high. You know, Apple's cost is going to be substantially higher than whatever X ounces of gold cost in the free market today.
Yeah, but I still don't think that the pricing has almost, with up for the high-end models only, has really anything to do with the cost of manufacturing your goods. It has everything to do with two parts. One, how many of these do they think they can make, which is probably actually does hinge on material, like how much gold do they think they can get at a reasonable price? And two, who are they trying to sell it to? Because, like we said, the markups could be hundreds of a percent. Like, that markup has nothing to do with costs of manufacturing and how many little machines have to polish the little things. Like, you're already, like, doing multiples of 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever. Like, and when you're picking those prices, you're picking them basically to say, this is now a status symbol. And the fact that it costs a lot of money is what makes it more valuable. Like, it's that, what is it, the Veblen goods thing, which we'll link again. Again, we discussed all these things on past shows that we're just rehashing now. But, that's what we're looking for. What signal is Apple selling, and is Apple trying to send with this product? And really, it's only about branding and signaling and fashion. And it's because no matter what the price, most people don't own gold watches, right? Millions of people own iPhones. Like, that is within the range of things that people can buy. And we already know the entry level price is going to be around iPhone price or actually less. That's where the volume is, right? And creep up, and then it'll get more and more expensive. And then there'll be like this bend, like a hockey stick somewhere that says, and here's the rich people version, right? And our question on all these past shows is, how much does Apple want to bend that? Do they want to bend it a little bit so you can get into an Apple Watch edition for $2,000? Do they want to bend it a lot so the entry-level model is $5,000? And what do they want the end point to be? Is the end point $10,000, $20,000, $30,000? Because at that point, it can be anything you want. And I think the reason people are getting cold feet about the 20, 30 grand top end now even is that they're saying, well, if Apple really wants to disrupt the market, the way they do it is by pricing it so that like it makes the other ones look like a ripoff, right? So they price it at $5,000 and all of a sudden the $10,000 watches look like a ripoff. Like, oh, the most expensive Apple edition watch you can get is $599.99. And now why would I ever buy a $10,000 Rolex? But at the same time, if you do that, then maybe people start to think of the Apple Watch as being cheap. And that's what we don't know, because none of us buy watches that cost as much as cars.
Right. And I mean, ultimately, yeah, I mean, this, like, I barely even wanted to write the article because like, I think the price is going to be really boring because none of us are going to actually buy it. But it would be interesting, like, if Apple priced it low enough that it becomes more plausible for more people to buy it. Like, suppose it's $3,000, you know, for the gold. Because I think that is just as plausible as it being $15,000, you know, because there's advantages to both sides. If it's $15,000, it's this, like, really, this, it's much more exclusive, it's much more profitable for Apple. If it's $3,000, they'll sell a lot more of them. And it's still way more profitable than the steel one, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's like App Store pricing. Like, what do you want to do? And that's why I think, like, you know, in addition to the signaling thing, it's like, well, if they have any kind of supply constraints on the gold or some other precious metal or thing or whatever, you can control that by just raising the price a lot. And then you sell fewer of them. You make the same amount of revenue by just selling fewer.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it's been funny to me listening to various podcasts talk about what they expect the pricing to be. And I think a lot of the more traditional nerds have been very upset at the thought that there would be humongous markups, like in the hundreds of percents or, you know, several hundred percent markup. And it seems like a lot of people think that Apple would never want to be seen as like, oh, a super expensive luxury good. John, I couldn't agree more with what you said earlier. I think that there will be just silly, ridiculous markups. And I don't know. I mean, I would say, since I guess it's reasonable for me to hazard a guess, that I think at least one of them will be north of $10,000. I think you'll find something that's more expensive than that. But it strikes me as funny that all the nerds seem to think that anything more than a few thousand dollars is just inconceivable. And I wish I could say the voice so you would know I was talking about the Princess Bride. But anyway,
that's a reference, John.
Yep, it is. So I don't see how it makes any sense for it not to be tremendous, tremendous money. Just like you said, John, because it's not about a piece of electronics. It's about a status symbol. And I think that's spot on.
Well, what if it's not? You know, because, you know, my point in my article was, you know, what if Apple's primary goal here is to sell a watch that anybody is willing to wear? And so some people are only willing to wear a gold watch. And so if Apple wants to get those people wearing an Apple Watch, they have to make one that's really fancy.
But the people who are only willing to wear gold watches are also accustomed to paying ridiculous prices for them. Because I don't think there's anybody who makes gold watches but sells them at like a 50% markup over cost. Like, I don't know enough about watches. Maybe there's such a thing that exists. But it seems to me that as soon as you get into gold watches, you get into the land of pricing is now just, you know, like based on the prestige of the brand, not the amount of gold in the thing. Like, we were just looking at the amount of gold to just basically say, like, no matter what, we know it's going to cost at least X, because that's just how much the materials and labor are going to cost. And that already pushes it up into four digits. And now we're just saying, like, do the additions start at four digits? Do they end in five digits? I don't think anyone has said they're going to start at five digits. I don't think anyone has said you're not going to be able to get an Apple Watch edition of any kind for less than $9,999. I think almost everyone thinks that the edition ones are going to start in four digits. And the question is, do they go into five digits, and how far do they go into five digits? And this will tell us a lot about how Apple wants to be seen as a brand. It won't tell us anything about how much money Apple wants to make or anything.
I don't know. We'll see. Anything else on the Apple Watch? Any other predictions we want to make?
Well, we have the real-time follow-up from the tipster who sent us the tip about the USB hub and everything. Just to clarify that the brick they were talking about, they're really doubling down. The brick they were talking about is not the power brick on the USB hub, but the computer's power brick.
Our second most boring tip.
Well, no, I like real-time follow-up. Hey, it's good. What that means is that I guess it means that the hub won't have a power brick, but it maybe have power pass-through, that like the power from the brick will go into the hub, and then from the hub's short stubby cable into the computer, because of course it's the power going through there. Should have just sent us like a picture of the thing. That would have just...
This is amazing.
In the grand tradition of rumors, you know, that like the blurry picture, maybe put it on the floor of an elevator. There's a deep cut for the Mac rumors listeners. No, you two don't even get that. Never mind.
Nope.
Someone in the audience will know about blurry pictures of things on elevator floors. That's for them. What else? I think the best thing, the best sad trombone about this would be if the March 9th event comes and goes and they don't mention anything about laptops. That'll be awesome.
No, I mean, keep in mind, like at the first Apple Watch event, they also released two iPhones.
Yeah, no, there's plenty of time. That's what we were saying in the beginning. Like, this is a press event. There's going to be watch details. There's room for something else. This seems like, because what else is ready to be, you know, what else is ready to be announced?
I mean, according to the rumor mill, nothing else is ready to be announced. I mean, you know, unless they talk about the other Mac, like the existing non-Retina MacBook Airs are allegedly about to get Broadwell, but that's boring. And I mean, they might mention that in passing while talking about this one, but you know, that's not newsworthy.
You say nothing's ready to be announced, but that just shows how much we've all given up on the Apple TV. The thing that's using a single core A5 or whatever the hell it's using now. It's like, geez. Like,
or the iPod Touch, similarly.
They could make a version of the Apple TV for the same price that's like twice as fast, and they could, in theory, make the software way better given that hardware, but they're not, for whatever reason.
Yeah.